Welcome back, everybody, and even if you don't have a body, but I recommend that you do. I'm Layman Pascal, and this is the Integral Stages Authors, a gross program, admittedly, but today we're diving into the subtle with Simon Cox around his book, The Subtle Body, A Genealogy, which tracks the divergent unfolding of multiple, mostly Western or Western-interpreted versions of the concept of non-physical bodies that mediate between the vitality of the physical form and other more abstract and elusive facets of our potential existence. And folks, if you're anything like me, you'd love nothing more than a good chat about how a multi-natural, subtle pluralism both challenges and rests upon the gaze of Neoplatonist Orientalists. So lay back, close your eyes, situate yourself snugly in the imaginal realm, and let's journey together to the plane of pure conversation. Hi, Simon.
Well, that was beautiful, man. And you've clearly read the book. That's awesome.
Good. Yeah, we got that out of the way. I've read the book.
That's good. I mean, that's a good start. That's better than most podcasters, I think.
Well, let's situate this in a life. Like, how do you go from the Batman to a coherent pluralist historiography of the subtle body? What are like the major beats in that journey?
Yeah, so that's kind of what I try to trace through the little, I have these little brief autobiographical kind of interludes scattered throughout my very dense and technical subtle body book. And that's, I mean, I tell the tale of going from being a kid, just a 90s kid, raised in like an atheist household in the sort of like post-historical 90s. So there's just like this, like the context was so like blasé, and so everything had been so profoundly desacralized that I think children like me had to, like, there's like a noetic yearning that we all have in our heart. And we found that in like Batman cartoons and like the most mundane things you can possibly imagine. So that's where my interest in this stuff started. It was the kind of my noetic outlet as a child was cartoon and comic book media predominantly. And I follow, basically, it's just kind of like recycled countercultural Orientalism that makes it into 90s Batman cartoons, where Batman studies mystic arts of the East and things like this. And that's the kind of trail that I traced and lived actually through my life that led me eventually to move to China to study Taoist martial arts for 6 years through most of my 20s on Wudong Mountain. And then I kind of came back and started a PhD program at Rice in 2014 to kind of make sense of my life, basically. And I ended up writing this subtle body book that's sort of a kind of psycho-spiritual autobiography, you might say. Yeah.
That's very, that situates the book in a very personal way. But what about it's like a more general critique? Like, what do you feel is missing from other contemporary accounts of this sort of material? What did you want to bring in that you saw was absent?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, well, I was really shocked. So when I went to grad school, and again, to get a little personal, like in China, we studied this inner alchemy and we learned these techniques of the manipulation of this inner fire. But our master made it very clear to us that he had not told us all of the secrets of the inner fire. And in grad school, I wanted to study classical Tibetan to learn about the Tibetan inner fire practices, Tummo and stuff like that. And so I studied Tibetan under my co-advisor, Ann Klein, and started reading the classical texts on the kind of structure of the inner body and the fire and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, I'm going to write a dissertation that compares inner fire in classical Chinese texts to inner fire in classical Tibetan texts. And I'll be like, so it's a comparing the subtle body of Tibet with the subtle body of China. And I was like, surely someone's written a book on the subtle body where they've like really kind of gone into this concept and explored it. And I found no one had. And there was like one academic volume on the subtle body, this kind of subtle body in Asia and religion in Asia and the West by Jay Johnston and Samuel Jeffrey. And it's a really cool edited volume, but it doesn't really go into the details, the genealogy of the concept, really. And so that's when I started writing this genealogy as like a preface to my dissertation. And then it actually became my dissertation because the actual comparing subtle bodies in Tibet and China was a massive project that I'll probably be working on for the rest of my life. So I wanted to, you know, finish grad school before I ran out of funding and stuff. So I just went with this little kind of preface project. But yeah, I mean, I did it out of necessity because no one had really done it before. And the subtle body, it's such a kind of appealing concept that people use across all kinds of fields. I mean, kind of from contemporary art criticism to, of course, areas of Asian area studies. And then, I mean, it's a totally ubiquitous in the New Age and kind of New Age spinoff and adjacent kind of movements that us millennials are really good at creating. But no one had really gone in and like dug into like, what is this thing actually? And so that's kind of what I tried to do through my book. And now I'm involved in this thing at Esalen where we're kind of trying to continue that project through these conferences we're throwing together.
It makes me very happy because I have the sense of a field beginning here. And it requires a very particular kind of person to contribute to the burgeoning of this field, because you have to have some personal experience of subtle body practices. You have to have experience of how it's grounded in some different cultures that make visceral sense to you. And you have to be willing to do the like high level analytical deconstruction work that people in those traditions often aren't interested in doing. So that's a very rare situation to be in. And I appreciate that you've taken it up.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah. Well, very well put. Yeah. So I'm curious about, because you're steeped in all of these fields and these discourses. And so like, what is this field that you see arising?
Yeah. What it looks to me like we've got something, and there's always a sketchy element to something like increasing developmental stages or layers, but I'm also have a background in people who think that way. So there's this notion of an increasing amount of transcultural complexity that we can bring into studies on things. And it's associated to some degree with certain like vague mappings of cognitive sophistication and things like that. But there are all these areas where nothing like that has been explored. Right? And I think those areas are to some degree well described by the different sorts of classical states. Right. So I grew up in a kind of theosophical framing. So gross, subtle, causal, non-dual, that kind of thing. And they're almost like separate ontologies that could all be explored through an increasing level of analytical richness. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't really been done. And in particular, it hasn't really been done because the sort of people who have those cognitive skills and inhabit academia don't have experience and don't have interest in a lot of altered state experiences.
Right.
But it looks to me like you need to do that, and you need to do that at a fairly sophisticated level in order for us to have a decent contemporary map of what we think reality is.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, there's almost a catch-22 to it. Kind of if you're like a sort of like you have the kind of psychonautical disposition and you delve into these altered states, then you're probably not someone who kind of spends a lot of time in this really, really high level and kind of very articulate analytic specificity that you're talking about. So it is, you need the sort of, Damascius, a kind of Neoplatonist, talks about these kind of these two poles of the Neoplatonic tradition. You have the theurgists and the theoreticians. And then, but he says a true Platonist kind of brings them together, is a Bacchus kind of figure that has the kind of analytic and the kind of hieratic kind of married together in his soul. So I think that's.
Yeah, I think it's essential for, let's say, cultural vitality or cultural health. And we've seen moments in history, like you trace some of this in the book, where these things have come together, right? There were periods, and they were very fertile cultural periods. Mm-hmm. So I think if we want to, as is necessary, consolidate some kind of civilization health at this moment of history, we've got to be able to bring these domains together and have them cross-fertilize each other. And so we need individuals who are capable of doing that based on experience, capacity, and interest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks, man. That's well put.
Good. What else? You know, I sort of, like I said, theosophy. I grew up on Blavatsky and some Blavatsky books and stuff that my grandmother had left me when she died. Like early 20th century meditation and experiments. And I moved on to Aleister Crowley, who was a marvelously interesting character. But cool. Until I read your book, I didn't really appreciate his role or his placement as sort of the first major subtle body theorist and practitioner to step aside from Oriental Romanticism and Neoplatonism, his approach. So maybe for people watching and listening, you could speak a bit about what Crowley's approach emphasizes and how that differs from the European mystical systematizers who had gone before him.
Yeah, I was really shocked by what I found in Crowley as well. And because Crowley wasn't part of my dissertation. I wrote this kind of dissertation where, I mean, the major theme of my book is that you see a lot of people talking about the subtle body and talking about the Orient, whether it's Tibet or India or China. But actually, if you kind of dig into what they're really doing, there's just, it's all kind of Neoplatonism being rehashed with different kind of like Oriental lexica kind of thrown over the top. I use this term creolization. So you have a deep Neoplatonic grammar to the subtle body, and then you have a sort of like a kind of Orientalist lexicon that kind of we paste on top. And so that's the major thing I trace through my book, show these people kind of talking about the subtle body expanding from India and Tibet and China, but all the while, really, they're just kind of Neoplatonists. But then, so when I sent my kind of proposal to Oxford, and I said I had sketched up a couple more chapters if they were interested, one was on Crowley and Julius Evola, and the other was on Paracelsus, and the editors at Oxford chose the Crowley chapter to go with. And so I spent most of 2020, actually, the height of the pandemic, just deep dive into Crowley, which was wonderful. And so I didn't know anything about, much about him at all going in. And what I found, he's like this, like, he didn't have the high level of education that most of the subtle body theorists really had. He went to Cambridge, but he kind of dropped out after 3 years. And it's not clear, so he wasn't steeped. He couldn't read Greek and Latin. He wasn't steeped in classical philosophy the way pretty much everyone else in my book was. And so he never got that kind of Neoplatonic programming that the Cambridge Platonists did, or that even someone like kind of Blavatsky would have gotten a little bit just growing up kind of as a Russian aristocrat. So Crowley, he just maintained this like radically empirical attitude throughout his entire kind of corpus. And so for him, he's approaching the subtle body stuff, basically using these kind of like the techniques of the Golden Dawn to begin with, and these really just like empirical methods of experimenting with these subtle bodies. And so it's not like a highly theorized object for him, even in the beginning. And so there's a significant section in my Crowley chapter where I'm talking about his attitude toward Orientalism, because Crowley loved the Orient. I mean, his early roommate, Bennett, you know, was kind of one of the first Englishmen to become a Theravada monk in Sri Lanka. Crowley goes to Sri Lanka and they both learn, he learns some like real, like actual yoga. This is in the kind of 1904 or something like that, from the Solicitor General of Sri Lanka. It's like really legit stuff for such an early date for a kind of an Englishman to be learning these things. And then Crowley traveled to China in 1906. He was actually searching for a Taoist master, but he was kind of down in remote Yunnan, southern China. So he didn't find anyone. He's kind of disappointed about that. But then at the end of the day, he's like, well, it's better I didn't find one, because I have a completely intuitive understanding of the Tao Te Ching and stuff like that. So his kind of maneuvers there are really interesting. But this is the thing. He goes to China. He goes to India. He goes to Egypt. And in all of these places, he gets kind of like absorbs the kind of Oriental cultures, but in a really kind of like amateurish and non-systematic way. And then he just mashes it all together. So he ends up creating something that's totally unique, and that it's not at all just like the Neoplatonic grammar with Oriental lexica on the top. It's actually like the Oriental content, his direct experiences in these countries, forms like the prima materia for his system. And that's why, it ends up being something that it really takes a departure from the kind of whole Neoplatonic story of everyone that's come before him.
I was thinking about this time in my life. So when I was in my mid-20s, I was living a kind of double life as a serious member of a Buddhist community and also like a wild experimentalist and idiosyncratic theorist on the side. And one of the things I remember doing at the time was what we call digital soul practice. And a friend of mine whose flat I often stayed at, we would just leave the TV on, connected to the video recorder all the time. And we would do extended contemplations of the digital image of ourselves, and then try to project our sense of identity into the digital image rather than the physical body. Try to see and feel from that perspective. So now here we are, right? We're present to each other as images of bodies exchanged through air and space in a virtual realm. To what degree do you think of the virtual or digital self as in any way being related to the various kinds of subtle body considerations of our ancestors?
Wow, cool. So that practice you just articulated sounds a lot like the traditional Tibetan practice of illusory body. Was that something you were tapped into? It's a Tibetan practice?
Yeah, I mean, I was like a little bit more Crowleyan in my take, as I just sampled and got my own impressions from little bits of a lot of different things. But yeah, I definitely see a lot of parallels to a lot of classical subtle body work in that.
Cool. Yeah. And I mean, that's also the main method of kind of like developing the fine body. Crowley uses the term from Vivekananda quite a lot about fine body, that Crowley articulates, in his, I think maybe it's his notes to an astral atlas. Or it's actually the made, no, it's the major section from Magic and Theory and Practice where he really goes into kind of the development of your subtle body where, yeah, you picture yourself, in front of yourself, and then you try and send all of your sensory data into that body. And so, yeah, I mean, I think like the kind of the occult reading of what you and I are doing right now, and you can use any kind of like classical framework to articulate it. Like these are, we're shooting out mnemonikayas or emanation bodies, and that's what these our avatars are appearing on these screens, like through, you know, yeah, like you said, through air and through electricity. I mean, it's profoundly occult. I think all technology is profoundly occult, and so I'm a huge fan of that reading, and I do think that there's something kind of transformative about all of these sorts of things. So in like Tibetan dream yoga, one of the kind of more advanced practices is you do different kinds of things when you're in the sort of dream state. And eventually you begin to, when you're in a dream and you go lucid, you try to multiply into multiple bodies, which is actually really difficult to do. The first few times I tried this, I would instantly wake up. But eventually you can have kind of an awareness in multiple dream bodies at the same time. And I see that, I mean, so that's like a regime of cultivation. And I think that's a kind of a practice that we've all been thrown into here in our kind of in the Zoomverse that we're all occupying now, is there's like this kind of conscious occupation of multiple bodies, the virtual avatar on the screen and the body sitting right here. And I think a lot of what seems like kind of like cultural level schizophrenia that's kind of going on right now actually can has something to do with this. And I think it's very cool though. Yeah.
One of the, I think, for me, most interesting parts of the book is tracing something like a war between theory and ritual in the Neoplatonists. Neoplatonists, I've never said it like that before. Neoplatonists, right? And I think a lot of people had that war within themselves. Some people sort of stabilized it, but a lot of people were in conflict between each other and within themselves. And I guess the question is something like, who won that war? Given that on the one hand, a lot of it turned into Christian ritual. But on the other hand, when you look at a lot of the philosophical scholars today, they don't mention any of the ritual aspects of what was going on in those theorists back then. So your sense of like who comes out on top in the struggle between theory and ritual in the Neoplatonists?
Yeah, I mean, so the ritual guys, the hieratic Neoplatonists definitely won in antiquity. The kind of post-Iamblichus Platonism is profoundly theurgical. And then, yeah, you're totally right to say how this that kind of actually seeded the kind of sacramental theory of Christianity, like a kind of pseudo Dionysius the Areopagite. His stuff was a lot of it was just kind of rehashed Proclus, Proclus's Elements of Theology, and that became like one of the main kind of sources for the sort of the theorization of things like the Eucharist and the transubstantiation in Christian theology. And so, yeah, I think you can draw a straight line basically from like Iamblichus into the theory of the transubstantiation in Christianity. So there's a really good argument to be made that a lot of the sacramental dimensions of Christianity at their kind of highest theoretical level are really just Neoplatonism. And again, so yeah, I won't problematize that. I'll just go with that. So the kind of, yeah, that sacramental or hieratic stuff definitely won out in antiquity. But then, as I trace in the book, in the kind of by the 7th century, this stuff had fallen out of favor with kind of through some more arcane developments in Christian theology. Now, this sort of like Neoplatonic theorizing specifically about the kind of vehicle of the soul, which is what I'm tracing, the okema, was kind of that was kind of an idea non grata. And so that kind of passes into history books and encyclopedias, basically until the Italian Renaissance, at least in the West. it continues on in a vibrant tradition in Islam that I don't know enough about to speak intelligently, but it's important to kind of always mention that that did continue. I have one little footnote about Henri Corbin talking about the kind of man of light and Sufism, stuff like that. But so I think the appearance of the kind of theorists winning out from our present day just has more to do with a kind of post-World War II ascendancy of analytic philosophy, which is like distinctly theoretical, linguistic, epistemological, and has nothing to do with the kind of hieratic anything like magic and philosophy completely don't go together. Which is preposterous to a classical Platonist. I have that quote from Heracles that the kind of like philosophy is about the body of light and its purification. And if you divorce the body of light from philosophy, it no longer has the same power. So that's a really intriguing statement to us, but that nothing could have been more obvious to a classical Platonist. And so, but I think the things are clearly changing. I'm good friends with Gregory Shaw. He wrote this fantastic book on Iamblichus in the mid-1990s. And Greg has been a big part of sort of like the kind of revivification of hieratic Platonism and reading into actual sophistication and how interesting it was. And so he's kind of part of a movement that's rescuing this kind of Platon from the jaws of the analytics, I would say. Because I had a philosophy professor in grad school who said that Iamblichus was like the Steve Martin of philosophy, just sort of like a like slapstick Platonism and stuff like that, like just a silly clown, you know. So I think that's the kind of analytic attitude toward this stuff. They're like, oh, that's just silly. They're just talking about doing magic, but it has nothing to do with real philosophy. Real philosophy is reading Plato and finding like the little tiny 2-page section in one of his dialogues where he seems to be analytic for like 5 minutes. That's what it's all about, you know?
Sure. It's easy to underappreciate how smart Steve Martin really is.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Okay, let's say we want to avoid a naive new age monosomatic normativity that thinks all the different traditions simply as complementary paths pointing to the same facts and the same source. Yeah. There's clearly an exaggerated, almost colonialist simplicity to that that's somehow similar to the people who make charts saying how the gods from one culture exactly correspond to the gods of another culture. And I was a kid who used to do that a lot. Oh, yeah. But even though there's a danger in that kind of over-correlation and in the marginalization of generative diversity through a lens of naive convergence, there's also some basic commonalities to human beings and human experience. Our physical bodies have remarkable similarities to each other, and it's likely that there are basic underlying structural features in common, at least to the phenomenology that leads us to our models of the subtle body. So how are you holding the balance of sameness and difference? Like this current moment in your life, how are you situating your thinking between unity and plurality? How do those interact in how you look at the field of the subtle?
Yeah. All of this really goes back to my experience in China, because I went there when I was 21 years old, and with an extremely naive, ontology, epistemology, metaphysics, these things were completely unarticulated for me. I was just a kid. But I grew up in a kind of new atheism was like big thing when I was a teenager, and I kind of embraced that stuff. I was really into like Hitchens and Dawkins and all this stuff, but I grew really tired of it really quickly because there's just like not much. It's very thin. There's not much there. And so you're kind of like, okay, what next? And by the age of 18, 19, I was already kind of like looking into something a little more sophisticated than that. When I went to China, I was living in a Taoist context, doing Taoist practices, speaking and dreaming in Chinese and all of these things, a complete like aesthetic kind of deep dive into a totally different world. And I was like, well, I'm going to approach this like a method actor. And I'm going to, even though I don't believe in all of these things necessarily, I'll pretend I believe in them. And let's just see what happens. And like what actually happened doing that for 6 years was like a kind of a radical shift of every dimension of my being, including how reality at least presented itself to me. Everything had shifted. Everything had changed. And so it gave me this sense that we have this capacity as humans to like a transformation that's way more radical than we usually appreciate. Because we stay in the same places and we kind of do the same things. And we think that that's just the way things are. But if you actually like pick yourself up and kind of resituate your entire being in a different sort of context, the transformation can be extreme. And that's where, you know, in grad school, I didn't, this is sort of like hazily existing in kind of my life, this kind of my thinking. In grad school, I kind of learned the tools to sort of articulate this stuff. And now in sort of like postmodernism, or the very end of postmodernism, wherever we are, postmodernism has this total fetishization of difference. Everything is about difference and like zeroing in on little tiny things. It's very micro and it's very difference oriented. And so what I thought I would do actually in engaging with the kind of these more high level discourses was just sort of like radicalize difference. Like, let's just take it to its logical conclusion and show that's where you arrive at a kind of multinaturalism or a kind of ontological pluralism. And that gave me a pretty like satisfying view for talking about the subtle body, because I think like at least in Taoist cultivation, there's this theorization where you're cultivating the body. You don't have the subtle body to begin with. It's something that you create through really kind of complex alchemical processes. And so I think depending on what processes you do and kind of what basic map you begin with, you can create different bodies. And that's kind of what I ended up theorizing. And I try to put it in kind of layman's terms when I talk like this, no pun intended. But I do in a kind of highly articulate using French theory and stuff in my book. Yeah.
The creating of it is really interesting. And I'm pretty versed in Gurdjieff's work on this. And they have a model in which one of the things I like about it is it sidesteps the classical question of, does everybody have a subtle body or does nobody have a subtle body? That some people can generate one on through certain disciplines and efforts. But that sort of flies in the face of a lot of classical articulations, which make the subtle body descend from the ontological background of the universe. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of hold that, what's more contemporary, generative, constructivist model of the subtle body when looking at people whose default assumption is that it's just built into the fabric of reality and into ourselves from the very beginning?
Yeah, well, I think if you take like a seriously multinaturalism, that you can have both of those, because you can exist within a reality where it is a kind of part of the generative fabric of the cosmos, where your kind of your cosmology maps into your anthropology, and that becomes the subtle body kind of schema that you're using. This is totally in all of the Buddhist articulations. I found this really, really like very well put in kind of Tibetan sources, where they're using a classic Yogacara kind of like emanationist, really cosmology that talks about how the kind of embryo, because both the cosmogenesis and the embryogenesis are totally aligned. They're the same process in kind of micro and macrocosmic terms. And so yeah, I think if you cultivate yourself into a world where that is the cosmogenesis and the embryogenesis, the anthropogenesis, then that's the kind of world that you're going to be living in. But I mean, the important part, I think, that I didn't really articulate well enough in my book is that I think it's like a multinatural or a polyontological form of cultivation. You can't just decide, I am now in a Hindu universe, and then you're in that. You have to embrace it, I think, and using the classical languages are actually a really important part of this from my perspective, according to my experience in China and stuff like that. When you embed yourself in a completely different affective linguistic cosmos over the course of years, then you actually tunnel yourself into that different reality.
Yeah, I think that's well put, or at least well thought, because the contradiction between we're generating it or it's part of the background ontology in which we're embedded, that dichotomy breaks down if the generative creativity is in the background ontology in which we're embedded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Obviously, this book follows a very classic Western story from ancient Greeks and Egyptians to a neoclassical revival in Europe, and then modernist and postmodernist revolutions, folding in Tibet and China as European explored territories. And you mentioned you'd love to know more about how the Islamic culture was holding this. But I'm really curious about how you relate to, or what your hunches are about we might broadly class as indigenous approaches, either meaning the civilizations and nations of the Americas, or meaning the like pre-recorded prehistorical civilizations of Europe and Asia, which were, I think, always worth noting, by far the longest period of human civilization.
Oh yeah. 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 Well, so I actually, in the very last paragraph of my book, I end, and I, this was kind of, I don't know what I was trying to indicate with this, but I end with a quote from this recent book, Aztec Metaphysics, where kind of we have to replace the kind of, what is it? Operation follows from being. From being follows from operation. And I have the, he puts it in Latin. Yeah, it's by this guy. I forget what his name is, but it's Aztec Metaphysics. And it's a really fantastic book, a kind of look into the kind of the poetry of the Tlamatinime, who are kind of like Aztec kind of philosopher priests. That a lot of this was recorded in Spanish chronicles from the 16th century in Nahuatl. And there's been some really cool work done on this stuff. So, I mean, this is something, yeah, in the end of my book, I'm like, look, I just did this kind of very sort of academic, myopic dive into this two-term thing, subtle body. But really, I mean, this concept, as we all know it, like, and we use it in day-to-day kind of parlance, is everywhere. Everybody has a concept like this. So it's totally present in classical kind of American ontotheologies, insofar as I've been able to gather what's going on there from different kind of sources. And now I live in British Columbia, where it's the kind of the Salish territory, S-Y-L-I-X, or Salish is sometimes it's called. There's kind of inland Salish and then coastal Salish peoples. And I'm right on Okanagan Mountain, in the middle of the Okanagan Nation, Salish territory. And so there's been a lot of really cool anthropological work done on Salish peoples since the 1970s. And so I've read a few kind of dissertations about this stuff. And I mean, the whole, and most of these American cultures that I've read about are what we would characterize as kind of animist, which used to be a bad word, but now it's being revived and sort of neo-animism is cool now. And there's all kinds of colonial problems with using both of those terms, but it's living in a kind of a totally enlivened world and cosmos. When everything is enlivened, then of course the body is enlivened. And there's this kind of very interesting kind of political relationships between your body and the world. So I'm not sure where to go with this one, but yeah. So what exactly are you trying to dig up here?
I was just curious whether you had any intuitions about interesting variants of subtle body theory and practice that you feel like might inhabit those cultural and historical regions and groups that we don't see in that kind of European lineage. But maybe we also don't see in Egypt and Asia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is so. Now I'm speaking in terms of the subtle body, kind of broadly construed. And this is the reason I get really specific in my book about just those two terms, because I'm trying to like give us like something really to kind of hold on to, because the subtle body, it just kind of slips through our fingers when we get too broad. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question, I think there's so much richness to be explored in these American traditions. And I've only just kind of begun on this project. But I will say, kind of on this same sort of vibe, is that when I do these kind of different subtle body practices, so I'm a part of a Taoist lineage in our alchemy, but I've also been exploring these Tibetan practices through Bun, the Bunpos, since I started grad school in 2014. And I find it really appealing to think of these different kind of movements of energy through the channels and these different practices as sort of like shards of from a lost, forgotten civilization that was like extremely spiritually advanced. Kind of like I have a sort of Atlantis mythology I play in my head that I really love. So I'm sort of like global highly advanced spiritualist civilization. They didn't have technology in the way we know it, but they had some sort of like spiritual technologies, and little fragments of that have trickled down to us through the ages. And that's the stuff that we're playing with and piecing together. And as an historian, I know this is probably like pretty preposterous, but like as a human being, and maybe more as like a millennial, I find it a really, really appealing mythology. And I sort of like feel it in my body when I'm doing these practices and think of them in this way, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to resist the allure of the imaginal proto-wisdom civilization when you have like organic personal experience and you see what look like similar fragments in different cultural traditions. Like
Totally.
imagining, like whether it was really there or not, I really honor that culture, even if
Yeah.
it didn't exist.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, me too. I just love it. And it enriches the actual practices that you do. Yeah.
Yeah, Tibet's very interesting because when I thought of myself more as a Buddhist, I had this notion of the rise of Vajrayana and Himalayan Buddhism as a kind of super enriched Buddhism that had absorbed the shamanism of the mountain people. But now I tend to think the shamanism of the mountain people might have absorbed Buddhism. That I'm sort of leaning towards a more indigenous framing of these things overall, which I think might have some relevance going forward in terms of working out a transcultural version of this. Like as a like we're never really post-cultural because we all have our embedding, but to be planetary in some ways is to be archaic again, in my sensibility.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. So that's an interesting track to think, because I was just thinking about these things sort of in a very personal way, this sort of like this great proto civilization as something kind of as a, some personal entertainment. But you're showing how it actually has value in kind of theorizing this sort of like the future of these cross-cultural kind of meaningful interaction.
Yeah, I have a sort of an instinct about that, but I also think there's reasonable ways of thinking about like archaic futurism as sort of an emerging aesthetic that's emerging for a reason that we're reaching back to and that we want our there's different ways to do wisdom cultivation and spirituality and things like that, but looking at the world situation, we kind of need all those ways to really embrace the body and really embrace ecology and really embrace not quite tribalism, but cultural generativity, things like that, ritual and ordeal, and the things that give us a cultural framework. So in some ways, there has to be a shamanic flavoring, no matter what tradition or non-tradition we find ourselves in going forward.
Wow, that's very cool. Yeah, I mean, it reminds me, it makes me think of David Gordon White's recent book, Diamonds Are Forever, DAEMONS. And in it, he basically, like, his main thesis in the book is that there's actually really, there's sort of one religion of Eurasia, and it's like demonology. And that we can view every other kind of religion that's arisen since then as different kind of negotiations of this basic belief in these in like in diamonds, who are kind of good and bad and everything in between. And I think I find that a really kind of compelling thesis and something that really, yeah, like ties lots of stuff together. And I would be curious about the extension of that kind of like thinking to the Americas.
Yeah, I liked the way you were talking about animism because I think the it really comports well with a like let's say trans postmodern or metamodern kind of philosophy where things are more lively and enchantment oriented, but also more distributed and multifarious. And that really goes well with like a pluralist notion of the psyche and the individual and a richer sense of the embodied and a kind of developmental psychology that's nested in parts work, but also in like the imaginal projection of parts work into the world that we live in, and the inability to fundamentally distinguish the psychological agent from the world in which they're embedded. So I think there's like a lot of leading edge theories that, I don't know, just comport really well with some kind of new animistic framing. Whether or not that's similar to ancient animistic framing or not, given that we might even not we only have our projections to some degree about what ancient animistic framing was in the first place.
A lot of things are kind of coalescing on some sort of neo-animism, I think, and fields that are complete, that are totally disparate and you would not expect. Like, I view this as one of the main thrusts of, like, these sort of new materialisms, rethinking what matter even is and what it means to be kind of embodied or material being. It's incredible how long the sort of, like, naive Newtonian, even though Newton himself wouldn't have even recognized that, kind of Newtonian kind of billiard ball view of matter has persisted. And so it's really exciting to be kind of breaking out of that and into something that's really, I mean, that is significantly re-enchanted and a re-sacralization of the material world.
Yeah, I think one of the nice things about, even though, like you're saying, Newton was more of an alchemical weirdo than we often give him credit for, it's easy to map certain things with numbers. You start with very obvious material objects. But after 100 or 200 years, especially as we move from algebra to computational engines, the number of things we can kind of map quantitatively reaches the limit of what we can comprehend, and it seems to operate like some, you know, multi-tentacled Cthulhu monster. It is what the numbers are now showing us. It doesn't look like billiard balls anymore, and that means that we have to situate ourselves differently in a world like that. We need to rely on intuition and nonlinear dynamics and something that looks a little bit more like magic than what we've been used to.
Well, far out, man.
One of the questions that came up for me in reading the book, or like cluster of questions, is around how things get grouped. Like, obviously each individual could be considered to have their own or multiple approaches to the subtle body, but then you chunk it in various ways, right? We say, well, do we adequately understand how the people of India viewed this, or the people of China, right? And that's a very fair question to ask, but we're already chunking that as if that's a legitimate block to use. And what do we mean? A geographic region or a language or something like that? So on the one hand, there's that question of how do you relate to what's an adequate continent of subtle body theory? And on the other hand, do you think there's something like hidden diversity in that? What do I mean by that? Like, okay, so like Meister Eckhart sounds suspiciously Zen when you read his writings. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Amida Butsu Buddhists pray to a compassionate Lord of Light that will give them salvation in the afterworld. Sounds suspiciously Christian. So might there not be like underlying functional categories somewhat independent of the cultural overlay?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. So this is kind of, so like I said, I started with this project where I was going to do, Chinese subtle body, Tibetan subtle body, let's talk about inner fire. And so, yeah, what you start doing when I started mapping these things, the Chinese subtle body. So I'm like, okay, we can bifurcate medical and Taoist subtle bodies. Okay. And then that's already like a fundamental division with, like, actually you already have multiple ontologies right there. And then, okay, let's talk about Taoism. And then it, like, the branches, it just gets so Byzantine. And the same thing is in Tibetan context, complete divergence, ontological, epistemological, metaphysical, not to mention anthropological, anthropogenic, genetic, sort of all the subtle body maps. There's just so much diversity in these different traditions that, yeah, you arrive at situations where there's the farthest, weirdest Taoist subtle body looks way more like this kind of body out of the Tibetan tradition than it does any of the other Taoist subtle bodies. So I think that's a really interesting might be an interesting ramification of a more comprehensive taxonomical project, where you are kind of like looking, doing deep historical work, looking at how these different things are mapped out and finding, then you could kind of empirically, kind of from the ground up, you could arrive at basic analytic categories that map onto these different qualities that aren't just these kind of neo-colonial kind of China, Tibet, basically these categories from like the Great Game in the 19th century, you know? So yeah, I think that's an argument for why we need more taxonomical work to be done on this sort of stuff. And I think there's a whole lot of PhD theses that can be written along these lines that I think would be really, really cool and really interesting.
Okay, years ago, I lived in Japan and I had a series of apparent past life downloads. And the interesting thing to me about them was they weren't whole lives, they were fragments of lives, right? They seemed in those moments as real as my current life, but they were only bits of stories from the past or the sideways or the made up or wherever that is. And it started me thinking about sort of fractional subtle bodies or fractional souls. And in the same way that there's a kind of revolution in physics from the Newtonian model to the quantum model, where in order to figure out with high accuracy where a particle is, you have to calculate where it sort of is in a lot of other places at the same time. Does it make sense to think about subtle bodies as swarms of potential subtle bodies existing in different degrees in different forms at the same time?
Cool. I love that idea. I'm a huge fan of the swarm. I think that the so speaking of taxonomy, I think that that's extremely Victorian, the way that we think of things as being like one or bifurcation and these kind of tree structures. They have their use, like I just said, it'd be useful maybe in the Soto Body Project. But yeah, when we're really thinking more broadly and ontologically, I think we live in the age of the swarm, you know? Like we know for now, like through kind of this theory of evolution, that on Earth that we don't species is kind of a Victorian conceit. It's really like a massive gene swarm that kind of that you use kind of that mathematics of fluid dynamics to model how these things and these sort of like these attractors develop and kind of form in like these different kind of patterns. So I think that thinking of the subtle body in those terms is mu probably much closer to what is actually the case than the sort of the more classical, like a Vedantic model, where you have your kind of indestructible kernel that kind of puts on different clothes and kind of sheds them as you go. So I find that really appealing, but it's also a little chaotic. So it's like it's hard, like analytically, to really embrace that and like think through its ramifications, because that's just like it's kind of combinatorially explosive when you're trying to like look at the where that leads you, right?
I enjoyed discussions in the book about, and some of this was in the autobiographical sections, how diversely sourced individuals from different cultural backgrounds can be drawn into similar practices through common myth themes, right? Whether they get those through cartoons or films or literature or oral histories or whatever. And tracing the lineages of myth themes seems fascinating. It reminds me of discussions I've had with some occult historians who are like painfully aware that they can't document the granule movements of secret societies because a lot of that information is missing, but they can follow the memes and symbols and postulate vectors of proliferation of those ideas over time. And I'm curious, obviously the book is textual based, but how much attention are you paying to a non-verbal chains of transmission of ideas about the subtle in the form of images, statues, patterns encoded in dances, architecture, things like that, especially as they might have come out of early cultures that were not primarily textual or writing oriented in how they thought about communicating this stuff.
So this is a major divergence between my own personal life, where I'm an ordained Taoist from a lineage that transmits most of this stuff. It's an apophatic tradition, and everything is transmitted outside of text through practices, physical, actual dances, martial dances, and sort of inner alchemy, and these things that are just transmitted through a sort of living with a master over many years. Like when you just sit and meditate with someone, even if they don't orally teach you things, your body picks up on things that are happening that you can't even understand, and that's the method of the transmission of knowledge of practice in this sort of Taoist, like cave Taoist alchemical lineage that I became a part of. And so, then on the opposite extreme, you have like technical, high quality historiography, where we're dealing with texts and we're dealing with sources and we're dealing with what those sources can actually tell us, which is not very much. Like if you really study history and get very involved in kind of come to understand history and historiography, the writing of history, you realize it's an extremely thin discipline that can only tell you such a tiny amount about anything, And then specifically about these kind of esoteric things that we're talking about that are specifically not written down. So I have a huge personal appreciation for how much of this stuff is encoded in non-textual sources. And that's what, in kind of looking into the kind of the more local Silic culture and the sort of where the sort of subtle animistic bodies kind of show up in that. And it's a story-based culture. So they tell stories. And there's lots of traditional dances, including kind of war magical dances that's what I've been kind of reading about and trying to get a feel for more, because that's often in kind of war magic, traditional war magics, which every society on the planet, I think, has war magics, including modern American for sure. That's where kind of you can find a lot of subtle body theorization kind of cooked into that stuff. So yeah, that's just to say that, like, as an historian, these are just like not really admissible kind of media. You have to kind of slacken your historical standards to take these things as evidence. But of course, this is where all of the interesting stuff actually is. So you can either be a good historian and not take this stuff into consideration, or you can just be an interested person and take it into consideration and kind of like let go of some of your kind of historical kind of the clenched butthole of historicism, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to cite a dance.
And there's just so many hermeneutical layers then that you sort of need to account for, and that's how you end up with very kind of postmodern prose where you're just saddling yourself with epistemic and ethical reservations, and then you end up just saying nothing at all. So yeah.
I don't know if you know the Canadian cognitive scientist John Vervaeke.
Yeah, I know John.
He and I hang out a bunch, and I was talking to him about he's very concerned that the imaginal, as opposed to the imaginary, in Corbin's sense, is given full rights as an important cognitive sense making function. So that's part of what we point to when we point to the subtle, is something like the imaginal. But we also point to something, and he's a little bit more reticent on this, even though he's a chi practitioner himself, subtle energy and how that relates to this whole thing. And in some kinds of classical approaches to the subtle, it's conceived a little bit like a spectrum or a gradient between the vital and the astral, between something like somatic stimulation and something like the imaginal. And I'm curious how you think about models that have that sort of vital energy pull and sort of pure luminous forms pull. Yeah. And on the other hand, what you think about subtle energy in general, in terms of it being just a nice way of describing flows in systems, or B, a name for bioelectromagnetism, which is a physical thing, or C, some additional type of energy that's frequently postulated in a lot of subtle body traditions.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah.
A big question. It's got a lot of parts. My
apologies. Yeah, that is a lot of, so there's kind of two main parts to it. It's about like energy, and then the other part is about this sort of like the polarity of a sort of vital and astral qualities.
Yeah.
In this Taoist tradition I found in Wudong Mountain in China, it was everything I had ever wanted, because I've been training martial arts since I was like 7 as a kid. But, you know, at a certain point, you're like, okay, I've done a lot of punches and blocks and kicks. What else is there to this? And martial arts, at least in movies, it always purportedly has this like spiritual dimension where you can go from like doing basic stances and the most kind of gross mundane movements to the kind of heights of spiritual life and ecstasy and stuff like that. But in all of my kind of martial arts experience in the West, they never really made that connection. You'd always get to like the most advanced techniques, and then it never really got very spiritual beyond that. But they'd be like, oh, it's there, we just don't know it, or something like that. And so anyway, I went to China and I found this tradition now where it has a whole package. It's really, really cool. And there's lots of historical reasons for that. The lineage itself has definitely been influenced by Kung Fu movie culture. So it's almost a bit of like kind of life imitating art, imitating life, that's given rise to this tradition. But it's a whole thing that goes from like horse dance and punches all the way to sitting in a cave and doing spirit travel. And there's a whole every kind of step along the way is articulated, and it's super cool. So there's this total link between like the vital dimensions and how the sort of like circulation and cultivation of that vitality that literally begins with Jing, which is your kind of seminal essence, sexual essence, and the sort of circulation kind of filtering of that gives rise to different things and different qualities within the body that eventually produces something where you can kind of leave your body with it. Do like Crowley style spirit travel, basically. So that I found a tradition that kind of ties those together. That's super cool. But on this energy front, yeah, this is a really interesting thing because I don't address it at all in my book. My book is like subtle body and just that term. And people are like, well, what about subtle energy and subtle energy fields? What about chi, ki, and prana and lung and so on and so forth? And so that's actually what I'm sort of working on a second volume to my subtle body book. And it begins more from the sort of subtle energy angle of things. And I'm doing the same sort of genealogical thing, going back and looking at subtle energy and energy fields. Because we had an Esalen kind of conference based on my book about a year ago. And it was predominantly people, John Vervaeke was actually at that. And there were a bunch of people on like in the sort of biofield world who are dealing with this like biofield. It was a term coined by the National Institute of Health in 1994. And it's a really, really general term for sort of like, yeah, biofields. And what exactly that is a matter of speculation, but investigation. And now there have been lots and lots of kind of scientific papers written on this. It's a very interesting and growing field. And so I was like, oh, these fields, this is very interesting because, I mean, when you look back into like field thinking in terms of energetic fields, people kind of assume that this is in all that that's what qi is in China and that's what prana is in kind of classical Indian stuff, but actually never use the term field. Like, they're not fields. Qi is not, like, they talk about fields in Taoism, but those are your elixir fields in your body. That has almost no relationship whatsoever to the way we think about these kind of fields interacting and stuff like that. And so that's when I started doing kind of genealogy of the field. And basically, I mean, there's a great Einstein quote from his book on the kind of the evolution of physics, where he talks about how the discovery of the field, the concept of the field, is the greatest development that's happened in physics since Newton. And I was like, oh, okay, so it's a post-Newton development. And so then I kind of went back into kind of Maxwell and his development of electromagnetism and then Faraday. And really, that's where kind of the rubber hits the road with just sort of like this field thinking and doing mathematics in terms of fields rather than discrete entities. So it's an extremely recent thing, talking about fields. And so really kind of what I view this kind of modern discourses around energy and energetic fields developing out of the scientific revolution. So you have people like Franz Anton Mesmer, and he was one of the first to kind of theorize this stuff, who are taking what are basically classical kind of folk categories, basically like hermetic resonance, and then these sort of like these occult relationships between things, and trying to formulate those in terms that would be satisfactory to a kind of like post-Cartesian, like the French materialists. Like, okay, let's talk about these things that are obviously real, but let's talk about them in kind of basically reductive materialist terms. And that's where Mesmer is like, it's a magnetism. It's a sort of form of magnetism, animal magnetism in your body that you can kind of move this stuff around. And that's where you first take what are kind of these classical hermetic and occult things. Like, this stuff shows up in Paracelsus. This is in Cornelius Agrippa. A lot of it comes out of the Picatrix, at least its articulation does. And then it's reformulated post-scientific revolution in modern materialist terms, in terms of fields. And so that's how we end up with this really interesting discourse around energetic fields. And I was able to kind of be like, oh, this, because of how I'm steeped in the kind of classical Chinese stuff, I was like, this isn't at all how people talk about qi. And lung either, and Tibetan stuff. And I'm not as well versed in Sanskrit and the Indic stuff, but I don't think that people are talking about prana fields probably before the 19th century. But now this sort of energy and field stuff has totally suffused these discourses. But it's a very modern way of thinking.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see like classical forms of spirituality constantly trying to adapt themselves to the scientific metaphors of the day. And then you gain something by that, but you also confuse something when you're trying to do that. Fields very recent with Maxwell and Faraday, but also the concept of energy itself is only a couple hundred years old. So then there's a question of Are we, to what degree are we misinterpreting what they were saying by using contemporary metaphors? And or to what degree do the contemporary metaphors give us a more accurate insight into what they were saying or not, right? That both of those are running in parallel. It's a fascinating field. I've been very interested in like very amateur taxonomies of these things, right? Though I know that a lot of chi theorists will say, yeah, we've already got that covered. There's every kind of chi. We already have a great map of all the possible subtle energies. But there seems to be a real significant difference between the ones that appear to be hyperconnected to oxygen of some kind and ones that aren't, right? Like it's, yeah, sure, your hand is buzzing, but that doesn't explain why you're supposedly breathing it in. It's in the atmosphere, right? That's a very different metaphysical proposition. I like that one. I've also been interested in the possibility of hybrids, right? Like, so if I take a very simplistic idea of head, heart, and body, and I go, okay, what if there was some kind of imaginal and/or etheric complement to each of those? What if then there's four different kinds of blends you could make, right? And maybe you make a blend between the mind and the heart, where you have like the heart informing the mind, but the mind's also leading the heart, and you get some kind of virtuous radiance. And that's different than if you're going to have the mind and the body operate as they do in Tai Chi, and you get the kind of physical thing that comes out of that, or animal magnetism, the mesmeric fluid. I ended up using that in my own thinking for like emotional and physical subtle blending, because there seemed to be a lot of placebo-inducing intensity in the way they were doing it. And I see something similar in great actors and performers who can put a lot of heart into their physical gestures, and that makes them seem magnetic or mesmerizing to us. Right. So that's just, you know, it's very clumsy kind of stuff. But I'm interested in the possibility of getting different kinds of taxonomies out of the blending of subdivisions of what we call the subtle energy.
I mean, I think all of us are doing that, whether we want to or not. Even the most like stodgy, like sinological, like I'm only following the Taoist taxonomy. Like you can't help. I mean, we're blender beings now at this phase of sort of like the blooming global culture that we're all a part of. And so you can't help but have these blended categories inform your own actually your own embodiment and your own experience of these things. I think like whether you want to do that or not, I think that's what's happening. And so I think we should kind of embrace that and kind of go with it. Because yeah, I mean, especially for someone like me who like I've written a book on this now, I'm so steeped in these things and I'm looking at all these different categorizations that you innately kind of whatever is going on in your head right now, that's going to influence the way that you're thinking and experiencing these things. And so I guess my grand theory in the book, though, is that what the map that we're going with at does matter, and that it different maps will take you to different places, basically. And so what I think then someone's like, well, what does that mean for like the new age where people are doing you have your chakras, but then you have like the Kabbalistic tree of life and you're just all mashing it all together. And I think that honestly, that's just we're sort of exploring unknown territory when we're doing serious regimes of cultivation based on novel maps.
Have you put much thought into interpersonal transmission dynamics, right? The possibility of things being exchanged between subtle bodies of two people, or of one person invoking or creating a subtle body in another, right? There's lots of different kinds of, not all transmission dynamics in spirituality are conceived as having to do with the subtle body. But I think there's some very interesting questions around what's the difference between imagining a flow that comes from one person and imagining two people going into resonance with each other in some kind of hybrid effect emerging from that. And where do we situate subtle energy and subtle bodies into processes like that?
I
There's
mean,
no specific question. It's just an open area of interest for me.
Well, yeah. So for anyone who's involved with these sorts of things in a kind of experiential way, that's obviously the case. That obviously happens that like two people, they're kind of come into resonance and alignment, and one person's your kind of subtle qualities affect that of another person. And you could even do kind of a reductive materialist read of this sort of stuff using different kinds of forms of kind of behavioral psychology and maybe the electromagnetic fields that we're exuding through our heart and our brain or something like that. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, this is. you know, my day job is a martial arts teacher. I have my own martial arts school here in Penticton. And, you know, there's like a kind of didactic, like a speaking instruction, like where we're actually telling people what to do with their bodies. But really, the way that people learn martial arts is through imitation. And it's sort of, you just do a movement, and then their body does the movement, and then they just pick it up. And when you have people coming to the school, like multiple times a week over the course of months or years, they pick up a lot more than just techniques from you. Like, they pick up a whole way of being in their body. And that's why it's really important as a martial arts teacher to be aware of how you carry yourself and do all these other things, because you're actually transmitting, teaching like these very subtle things to people that actually pertain to kind of your emotional state and all of this stuff. So I'm always very careful, like, what state I'm in when I'm going in to teach martial arts, because I'm like, people are opening their bodies basically to whatever state I have. And so I only want to pass good stuff onto the students, right? Most of the communication in my life happens on this level that you're talking about right here. But as far as like articulating that, yeah, I haven't thought seriously about how to language that sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay, so you're up there in inland Salish territory, and there's a famous lake monster in Lake Okanagan, the Ogopogo. And
oh, yeah.
It makes me want to ask about non-human subtle bodies, other kinds of entities and species. What's your take on, non-human subtle bodies of various kinds, and whether, you know, how do you see them situated in these different maps? What are the different approaches to whether there's subtle things, creatures, entities that we could interact with that don't necessarily have physical organisms like us to go with them?
Yeah. I mean, this is really kind of where I'm interested in taking this kind of subtle body stuff we're doing at Esalen next. This is the exact direction that I'm interested in going. Subtle bodies of kind of non-physical organisms, but also of plants and animals. And so, yeah, I mean, I won't get too far out, but just since we live on 14 acres that backs up onto a provincial park, so it's just like 60 miles of wilderness behind us, basically, that's full of animals. And it's really interesting being here. But moving out here, both my wife and I had direct experience of things hovering around that impinge on your dreams significantly. But you can just feel it sometimes. It's just palpable. So where my parents live in New Mexico is the same way. You're at their back door at night, and the hair rises on your arms. It's freaky where they live. It's not scary where we live, but it is where they live. But anyway, so Taoism has such a fantastic kind of way of talking about the subtle body, because already our body is, we're just an ecology of spirits. And it's roughly based on the sort of structure of your internal organs. So there's kind of like seven spirits that live in your lungs, and there are three spirits that live in your liver. And then you have all these different spirits that live in all these other places in your body, and they have these political relationships with one another. And a lot of the early phases of Taoist cultivation are just making sure everybody gets along. And so, because there's also elemental correspondences. And so you don't want the wood, you don't want the metal chopping down the wood. And then you don't want the fire burning up the wood, and you don't want the wood kind of like blocking the earth too much and stuff like that. So there's kind of elemental kind of pacification, but then also these kind of political relationships you develop with these spirits within your own body. And when you embrace an ecology like that, an internal ecology of multiplicity, of kind of intelligences, then the sort of to have multiple intelligences existing around you in the world is totally obvious and unproblematic. So it seems far out coming from kind of my Western 1980s American kind of worldview, where we're like, we have like, our mind is completely sealed inside of us. It's a hermetic box. Nothing gets in or out, you know? Whereas in China, it's this much more porous thing, and their spirits, and they kind of come and go. And I found that a way more healthy way of thinking about yourself and your psyche.
What about a potential normative dimension to plural subtle ecologies inside and out, like something like subtle body versions or something connected with all of my internal physical diversity. Okay. But then do I have a task in life of trying to integrate those into a kind of functional semi-unity that allows me to do some other operation? And then similarly, looking at the subtle ecology of the greater ecosystem in which we're embedded, do we have a role? Do we have a function? Are we an organ in that system? So what about sort of ethical suggestiveness and normativity in all of this?
Yeah, so all of that stuff is kind of accounted for if you choose to embed yourself in this kind of full Taoist sociology, which is what I did, which I found that quite necessary, being a kind of millennial and like post-historical, post-truth world that we grew up in. I sought embeddedness that I didn't get from my own culture, which was itself in this phase of kind of shedding like culturality. It's a really interesting time to grow up. And so I had the sort of like the millennial neo-traditionalist kind of thrust. And so I sought to embed myself in a kind of like comprehensive worldview. And so that's what I did, but I did it kind of in an experimental way. But yeah, when you do that in the kind of the Taoist context, and you are just this ecology of spirits, and what you do is kind of pacify the relations in between those spirits together. And then that sort of pacification, this sort of like stillness and tranquility and clarity, is actually the entire process. You pacify the spirits within you. And then as a sort of pacified being, you kind of like move through the cosmos like a little yin-yang swirl, and you basically create harmony like wherever you go. This is the model. Through De, like the Tao Te Ching, that's your De. You just sort of emanate this a kind of harmony existentially. So it's not even through things that you do, but it's more just through your being itself. And that's sort of this model of actually Taoist spirit travel and all of these things, because you harmonize the relations, and then through the alchemical process, you create the sort of immortal kernel that can egress through your the top of your head. And then you can travel to all these different cosmic realms and basically do a grand tour of the entire like cosmic system. And everywhere you go is sort of like cleaned up, pacified, and clarified by just your presence. So yeah, there's this ethical imperative that extends from the kind of your own kind of psychological integration to the grand harmony of the entire cosmos through all time. Yeah.
Here's a question I think has no real answer, but is there novel emergence in the subtle, right? Because like, it's not that Taoism doesn't include this, but a lot of the Asian phrasings sound like we're constantly restoring balance and harmony, as if it's sort of a pre-given thing to which we're returning, as yeah. opposed to an unpredictable process that might be making a totally new thing that none of history prepared us for. Mm-hmm. Is there novel emergence in the subtle?
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think, yeah, the way that you phrase the question really gets to the heart of the issue, and that is basically, what is the shape of history, right? I mean, so like Taoism and all of these, this sort of Prisca Theologia, the sort of like ancient, pristine wisdom civilization we were just kind of loving over, those all posit some age of harmony and peace and balance, and then something happened, something bad happened or whatever, there was a mistake. Or maybe it's just part of the narrative of the cosmos itself. Things fall out of balance. And now we're in our current time where like things are crazy, things are out of balance, and it's our job to get back to that pristine thing we started from. So that's this kind of classic Prisca Theologia model of history. But then, you know, really in the scientific revolution, and I cite David Hume as the main guy who cites the kind of like, or Thomas Hobbes as well, the sort of one where things were bad. And through our development of kind of human institutions, this kind of Steven Pinker model of history too, things are getting better and better and better. And through technology and everything, we're going to make it all even better. But the one that you're kind of suggesting here, maybe it's neither of those actually. And it's much more maybe a little Discordian. And so like, is there emergence within the subtle? So I view a kind of historiographical lenses and frameworks as basically altered states of consciousness that we can adopt and discard depending on kind of what we're doing here. And so I think there's a sort of like a chaos version of historiography where there's not a shape. It's not bad becomes good. It's not good, bad, good, ternary structure or whatever like that. maybe there's nothing at all. We're kind of like 12-tone historiography here. We're in like Coltrane territory. Then yeah, sure. There's totally, I mean, that's where I think the sort of like Crowleyan empirical attitude can be really, really useful. Let's throw out all the frameworks. We don't need Orientalism and we don't need historiography. It's just you and here you're in this experience, in this experiment, and what happens? Yeah.
Okay, so you are, and I guess we're probably coming close to the end of this now. So you're doing this work at Esalen, you're thinking towards plurality of views on subtle energies and the role of non-human subtle bodies. What else do you see in the immediate future? If you are in some part the custodian or responsible for ushering in, opening up, playing a role in a new field of study, what else needs to be explored at the next couple of steps in this study? If people are watching or listening and they want to be involved in this kind of inquiry, what would be excellent places for them to investigate as far as you're concerned?
Oh, yeah. I mean, on the most like conservative end of the thing, just more area studies, people who are nerdy enough to learn ancient classical languages, like teasing apart these taxonomies within Tibetan Chinese contexts. These are projects that are just beginning. Because, I mean, of course, subtle body and subtle energies, these were completely unrespectable fields of inquiry until very recently. But now you can actually do this stuff, and it's cool. I got published through Oxford. I mean, I didn't expect that to happen. So like, yeah, you can do really cool stuff and using conservative methodologies. And then on the far kind of non-conservative end of this stuff, you know, my main advisor was Jeff Kripal, and he is really, really involved in the kind of UFO stuff. And as that stuff is becoming more, I mean, disclosure, we're right in the middle of something happening right now. I think that stuff is totally involved here. And it's very just interesting hearing the kind of remarks of like, now American congressmen talking about how like these things are not extraterrestrial, they're extra dimensional, or Tucker Carlson talking about the spiritual dimension of the UFO. Like, whoa, this is weird. Like Jacques Vallée stuff is coming into the mainstream. And I think there's something totally related here with this sort of like subtle body, subtle energy, and this sort of experience of these spirits and things that are both internal and external that we're seeing in the sky through military optical technologies. So that's a really far out way to place that it's going. But I do think all of this stuff is of a piece. And I mean, the historical topic that I'm dealing with is the subtle body. But really what is more interesting in my book is this sort of the development of new epistemologies and kind of more holistic and really confessional and autobiographical ways of talking about this stuff. So always keep your own story like kind of centered in your mind, wherever you're coming at this stuff from, because that's what's actually really, really interesting about this, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to a UAP retreat on the Sunshine Coast this coming summer. We're trying to think through a lot of this stuff, but I don't think we can make sense of this stuff. And it's important to make sense of these things because they have the ability to disrupt or deregulate or add to the overwhelming sense of unreality and absurdity that's starting to govern the world. So we have to be able to make sense of these things one way or another. And I don't think we can make sense of them purely on the terms of the physical journey from another world. We've got to fold in this multidimensional subtle stuff that's always been with us in order to do that. I guess my only other question here is, what's the potential role of AI, quote unquote, in doing this? Is there some way we can start to harness our new digital tools in doing some of the analysis and the sense making work for us around this stuff?
Wow. Yeah. It's weird how on point all of your questions have been, Layman. Like every single thing you've asked is like stuff that I'm actually working on, but I haven't like written about or whatever. So anyway, there's some kind of subtle resonance, I think, between us. Yeah, AI is actually becoming a huge part of the project I'm doing with Esalen. The kind of the chair of the board at Esalen is this guy, Dave Morin, who's a kind of Silicon Valley tech guy, and he's really into AI. And so Dave and I are actually working on developing kind of like basically subtle body GPTs, where I'm starting with an experimental, it's a Taoist alchemy GPT, where I'm just feeding it tons of information from Taoism and specifically on Taoist inner alchemy. So the kind of more narrowly focused you can make these GPTs, the better off you are. But it's really impressive so far. It's kind of scarily impressive how I'm asking it extremely specific questions about very specific processes within Taoist inner alchemy, and it's able to give me very on-point answers where it has then the sources and everything it goes back to. And it's very good at reading English and Chinese, I think, because the internet is predominantly English and Chinese. It's horrible at reading Tibetan because there's not much Tibetan stuff it's been trained on. But it's even really good at reading classical Chinese and classical Chinese poetry and parsing that. Really impressive. So that's on the kind of the conservative historical end of this sort of this stuff. You're developing these GPTs that are well-versed in classical literatures that can kind of constellate massive amounts of sources that even a really intelligent human would have trouble kind of wrestling all of that material. And so my goal is to create kind of multiple of these GPTs that are versed in specific historical traditions. And then, yeah, we're looking to bring them kind of into conversation with one another. And Mike Murphy at Esalen, this is also, he's really, really into this project. So yeah. Yeah, it's really cool, man, where AI is headed with this stuff.
This has been great. I like the book. I like the approach you bring into all this stuff, and we should probably check in periodically.
I agree, man. Yeah, thanks so much. This has been a wonderful interview. You're well prepared, my friend.
Cheers. Be well.
Thanks. You too, man.